Welcome back, everyone. We're ready for another deep dive into unraveling the fabric of fear. So we've spent some time previously looking at how those, well, disharmonious thought patterns can develop.
Right. And also the way society tends to react, often quite harshly, using terms like sin or crime.
Exactly. And those words themselves carry a lot of weight, don't they?
They absolutely do.
Well, today we're really getting into something foundational. We're diving into chapter 11 of Unraveling the Fabric of Fear.
Ah, yes, the inherently subjective definition of justice. This is a really crucial chapter.
It feels like it. Because before we can even properly discuss how to respond to actions we find problematic, we kind of need to unpack what we even mean by justice.
That's the core of it. The mission for this deep dive, if you like, is to explore just how subjective that concept really is.
Right. What does it actually involve? And what are the implications for our reactions? The chapter really pushes us, doesn't it? Pushes us to question if our current methods are truly fair or effective. So you might want to prepare for a few aha moments, or maybe moments, because we're looking at a word we use all the time.
Justice.
But it turns out it's, well, a lot more nuanced, maybe more personal than we typically assume.
So to get into chapter 11, maybe we should just quickly touch on a couple of ideas from earlier, just to set the stage.
Good idea. So remember that basic framework. Emotions as energy, fear, and curiosity on opposite ends, and how we're, you know, conditioned by our experiences right from the start.
Exactly. Our environment shapes our thinking, and that ties into fear popping up when we don't understand something, while curiosity is, well, it's about being open, dropping expectations.
Right. And this conditioning, it leads to that idea from chapter 10, good people who've learned disharmonious patterns from their culture, patterns we might call sins or crimes.
And the labels we use are huge here, aren't they? Like we saw in chapter 9.
The source mentions Catherine Hoke's point again, the difference between calling someone a criminal and a person who committed a criminal act. It sounds subtle, but it's not.
Yeah, and Tim Ferriss's point about depersonalizing issues, that label felon, chapter 11, highlights how much weight that carries.
Okay, so where do we start? How does the chapter define justice?
Well, it kicks off by laying out some common ways we think about it. First, justice as something that's deserved, something that's needed.
Okay, needed or deserved.
Second, as a process that aims for fairness, impartiality, trying to get a result that's, quote, equally favorable to all.
Equally favorable to all. That sounds like a high bar.
It does. And third, it's seen as a process that adheres to reason.
Right. Reason. That seems straightforward enough initially.
Ah, but then the chapter immediately brings in the definition of reasonable.
Okay, so how does that complicate things?
Well, reasonable is defined as, you know, sensible, rational, having sound judgment, also fair, just, moderate, not extreme. And finally, satisfactory, or sort of meeting expectations. But here's the kicker.
Yeah.
The chapter points out straight away that all these facets, sensible, fair, satisfactory, they're all fundamentally subjective.
Meaning, what seems perfectly reasonable or fair to one person
might seem completely unreasonable or unjust to someone else.
Exactly.
Wow. Okay.
And the crucial point the chapter makes is that our reactions, the things we deem appropriate responses to disharmonious actions, are just as subjective, just as open to interpretation as the idea of reasonable itself.
So when you hear someone say, that's just not fair, or justice demands X,
their definition of fairness or what justice demands might be totally different from the next person's based on their own background, their own conditioning.
That really highlights how much our personal viewpoints shape this concept we think is universal.
Okay, so justice isn't this fixed, objective thing. Now, the chapter then shifts to how we actually respond, focusing on that tension between punishment and rehabilitation.
Yes, and this is a really key part of the discussion.
Sam Harris has that quote in chapter 11. The urge for retribution depends on our not seeing the underlying causes of human behavior. Basically, if you saw the whole picture, maybe retribution wouldn't be the first impulse.
Okay, so if these disharmonious actions, as the book calls them, stem from fear, ignorance, apathy, which themselves come from conditioning and maybe structural issues, then what does that imply about punishment? It brings up that sin system conundrum from chapter 10.
Right, and chapter 11 asks pretty directly, if you take someone who's struggling, who's learned these patterns, and you enforce social disconnection like prison and slap on a label like felon, does that actually help them build compassion, empathy, curiosity?
Or does it just deepen the fear, the separation, maybe the shame?
Exactly. The conundrum is it a sin or crime, in a way, for us to condemn people without fully considering the causes of their actions and, crucially, the effects of our own reactions? Are we part of the problem?
Mm. So the sources are pretty critical of punishment as the main tool.
Yeah, they reference Peter Joseph's point about operant negative conditioning punishment or the threat of it. It can change behavior short term, maybe, but it's seen as incomplete because it doesn't touch those underlying social preconditions. It's treating a symptom, not the disease.
Which leads to that Bertrand Russell analogy the chapter brings up, treating crime like an infectious disease.
Yeah, I find that really thought-provoking. You might need to restrict liberty for public safety, like a quarantine, but the attitude is different. It's about care, commiseration, focusing on finding a cure, not assigning blame or guilt.
A public health perspective, basically.
Right. And the sources point out that this kind of thinking is largely missing in how justice is practiced, particularly in the U.S. context mentioned.
So if the system is so focused on punishment, the sources argue it makes the term rehabilitation kind of hard to take seriously.
That's the implication in Chapter 11. Yeah.
Yeah.
Seems contradictory almost. And that ties into another fascinating question the chapter raises. When do we actually declare an outcome? When do we say, right, done, justice served?
Yeah, that's a deep one. Does putting someone in prison for X years or giving them a fine actually constitute an end result? Does it address the underlying issues? Does it prevent future harm?
Or are we just focusing on the immediate penalty and not the long-term effects?
It often feels that way. And speaking of long-term effects, the chapter goes into the psychological damage of forced captivity and social disconnection.
Right, and not just for the individual involved.
Exactly. It stresses the impact on their families, their support networks. We know social connection is vital for well-being. It's almost like a biological need.
We've talked about that before, how isolation can cause real harm.
And the chapter links this directly to feelings of powerlessness, losing your independence, and how that connects to mental and physical health problems. It takes a huge toll.
Now, the chapter also tackles something maybe less obvious, the impact of public labels, like being called a felon.
Yes, this is crucial. The chapter argues this kind of label creates significant psychosocial stress. Yeah. It compares it to, like, poor diet or pollution in terms of health impact. It even calls it a form of structural violence.
Structural violence. Can you unpack that a bit based on the chapter?
Sure. The chapter explains it as preventable harm that comes from inequalities built into our social systems, our institutions. So if the system assigns a label that permanently hinders someone's ability to reintegrate, find work, feel valued, that's harm caused by the structure itself.
And it details how damaging that public record can be, right? Not just abstractly.
Oh, absolutely. It affects jobs, housing, loans, basic stuff. And it hits their social value, their self-worth. The chapter mentions research on how negative expectations, the Golem effect, can hold people back, and even links social status to brain chemistry, like dopamine activity.
So facing constant rejection can actually have a physical effect, making it even harder to move forward. It sounds like a terrible loop.
It really does. Which leads the chapter to ask, you know, is this public criminal record likely to encourage change or discourage reoffending?
If you're constantly blocked and punished, what's the incentive?
Exactly. And it questions the term R-adapt. If this label creates a whole new, much harder life, is it really readapting to something normal?
Or just adapting to a permanently disadvantaged state?
That's the implication. The chapter even asks, well, why do we have these public records if our system is supposed to be effective at preventing reoffending?
What does it suggest?
It sort of hints that maybe they serve more as a warning, perhaps a warning about the system itself.
And it connects this to some very serious outcomes, doesn't it?
Yes. It explicitly mentions the link between exposure to the criminal justice system and issues like suicide, depression, and mental illness. It's a very sobering connection to draw.
Incredibly sobering. And then there's the economic side of it, too.
Right. The sheer cost of navigating the legal system can push people down economically.
Which we know links to other problems.
Exactly. The chapter reminds us of that established link.
Yeah.
Lower socioeconomic status correlates with higher crime rates, mental illness, poorer health, less education. It's that cycle again.
Which brings us to the chapter's really potent conclusion on this point.
Given all this, the cost, the social disconnection, the damaging labels, can our current method of implementing justice be considered a form of structural violence?
And the chapter's answer.
It says that based on current scientific understanding, the answer seems to be yes. It even quotes Dr. James Gilligan.
What's the quote?
Not only does structural violence kill more people than all the behavioral violence put together, structural violence is also the main cause of behavioral violence.
Wow. That really reframes the whole issue, doesn't it? It suggests the system designed to deal with violence might actually be contributing to it.
And from there, the chapter explores, well, what about rehabilitation without punishment?
That sounds almost paradoxical to how we usually think.
It does, but the argument is quite compelling. It starts by saying disharmonious actions come from fear, ignorance, or apathy.
And several things stand out. Education is a big one.
Yeah, the stats are pretty compelling there.
Very. Chapter 11 cites research showing education programs in prisons significantly cut recidivism. Like a 43% reduction in the likelihood of returning within 3 years for those who participate. That's huge.
43%. Wow.
And this connects to the idea of applying a growth mindset from Chapter 8 to justice itself.
Ah, right. Believing growth is possible. Learning from feedback. And it's not just about what happens inside, is it? It's about reentry, too.
Absolutely crucial. The sources stress the need for a community support system when someone comes out. Feeling like you belong somewhere, having connections, communal obligations, it leads to better outcomes.
And those connections can lead to jobs, which the material says is vital.
Vital, yes. Another massive theme is self-worth.
Ah, yes. Feeling good about yourself.
It's presented as fundamental. Chapter 11 quotes someone involved in addiction recovery, saying improved self-worth is key not just for recovery, but for having a more effortless existence. It affects relationships, work, everything.
Even the act as if idea is mentioned, like a way to start building it back up.
Alongside deeper work, yeah. Our sense of self-worth being linked to how others see us. Social status.
Social identity theory, the golem effect, even brain chemistry, like those monkey studies on dopamine and rank.
All of that. And how consumer culture can actively chip away at our sense of adequacy.
Right.
So if you connect those dots, it suggests real rehabilitation has to involve rebuilding that internal sense of worth, addressing shame, which chapters 10 and 11 link to violence, and providing real external support. Not just consequences.
It's a much deeper approach. There's also the psychological side, coping skills, resilience.
Yes, psychological strength, self-compassion, emotional resilience. These are correlated with fewer problems during incarceration and better outcomes after release. Mindfulness programs get mentioned as helpful for self-compassion and managing emotions.
And having a sense of purpose, meaning even while incarcerated.
Also linked to less depression and anxiety and more pro-social behavior.
Chapter 11 brings back those ideas of cultural relativism and cognitive bias from Chapter 7. How do they fit into this picture of subjective justice?
Cultural relativism, as the sources define it, means we tend to accept what's normalized in our culture. Our reasoning kind of falls in line with the norms, even if they seem irrational from the outside.
Like our idea of being adult is culturally defined, as Chapter 7 noted.
Exactly. And cognitive biases, those mental shortcuts and errors tied to our social conditioning. Remember Chapter 10 on Bernays, herd mentality, wanting to fit in. So those biases and cultural norms inevitably shape what we perceive as just or fair, what seems like a reasonable punishment, or even what we notice as problematic in the first place.
The sources mention examples, like maybe overlooking systemic causes when judging individuals, or how court fees hit poorer people harder. These things might seem normal because of our biases and conditioning.
Precisely. It reinforces that our justice isn't an objective fact. It's a product of our specific social lens.
Which brings us back around to blame and forgiveness. We talked about the blame cycle in Chapter 2.
Yes, blaming the person, not the learned pattern, creates victims and keeps the cycle going. Identifying as a victim fuels it.
And the opposite of blame, fear, is forgiveness. Love, curiosity, connecting back to Chapter 1. The sources argue strongly that only forgiveness, drawing on Chapter 3's insights, can break that cycle.
Right. And Chapter 11 touches on religious and spiritual perspectives that echo this forgiveness, compassion, nonviolence, love covering wrongs, not judging, overcoming anger with non-anger. It's a very different framework from retribution.
It makes me think of Chapter 7 again, that idea of recognizing our own potential for misunderstanding, being humble and curious instead of certain and prideful. Maybe a truly mature view of justice needs that humility, that willingness to forgive, to look beyond simple blame.
So, common threads of compassion, forgiveness, understanding.
They emphasize interchange and addressing root causes, which resonates with the chapter's focus on fostering compassion and looking beyond just the harmful act. Which leaves us and you listening with a pretty significant thought to mull over. Given how subjective justice is and how our systems might even cause harm, structural violence, how does our understanding of an appropriate reaction need to shift? How do we move towards something that feels more genuinely just and rehabilitative for everyone?
This has been incredibly insightful, definitely a lot to think about.
What if everyone you meet poops resentment at you? We'll find out in the next episode on addiction. And as always, stay curious, keep questioning everything, and for goodness sake, don't stop digging now. Until next time, dig deeper.